p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, Portland and beyond. It's 9 o'clock and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up on KBOO, it's Veterans Voice Radio with Northwest Vets for Peace. Marvin's here, waiting in the wings. At 10 o'clock, it's Radio Zine. Suzanne LeGrand talks with Pamela Newkirk, an award-winning journalist, NYU professor, and the author of the recently published book, Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. And then at 10:30, Film at 11. It's a panel broadcast reviewing the latest films and shows from the multiplex to the art house and beyond. Then at 11 o'clock, it's Pacific Underground, the show by and for Asian and Pacific Islander communities. And we thank you for tuning into KBOO and supporting the programs. They're made possible by you, by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on donate. And here comes Veterans Voice.
In his pulpit sermon, go and fight what is right, but he don't have to hear these guns, and I bet he sleeps at night. He could see those flies wouldn't preach for the sound of guns.
Portland calling. Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, 91.9 FM Hood River, or on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And you can hear our earlier shows on kboo.fm/Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and Tammy is in the air room. And that song that we just played, it was by the Zombies, and it's about World War One, guy in the trenches in World War One, and I thought it was just an interesting song by the Zombies. And on the half hour, we're going to play another song. And then I'm going to open up the phone lines at 503-231-8187. I've got a question I'm going to ask and see what kind of feedback I can get on this. And, you know, it's been bothering me for quite a while. And it's I'm going to ask where in the world they came up with national interest, how we have to send our troops all over the world for our national interest. And I want to talk about that, and I want to hear what you have to say about that, how they use that to get us in wars. And I think that, man, it's just pretty horrible. I got a few things I want to talk about today. And one of the things, today's an anniversary, Tammy. Today's an anniversary. Yeah. Today is starting of our 29th year on KBOO. 29 years we've been on this radio station, and it has to do with you, all you listeners out there. And I want to thank everybody that called in for our last pledge drive to keep this station going. When it hits the fan, and this station will be on the air doing its job since 1968, I believe. I have this book. It's The Last Day by John Pilger, America's Final Hours in Vietnam. And John Pilger is a great documentary filmmaker. And he's also a reporter. He's originally from Australia, but he lives in England. He had a documentary on Vietnam. He reported there for years, and he has this one documentary. It's called "Silent Rebellion" or "Silent Resistance" or something like that. I can't remember exactly. And it talks about, at the end of the war's going down, and everybody doesn't, you know, why are we here? And guys refusing to go out on patrols and different things like that. The breakup of the command structure in Vietnam and all of that. And it's a really good, the silence, boy, I was going to remember that so I could tell you, it's the silent something. And he talks to all these guys out in these fire support bases and everything, and they're saying, like, all the lifers, you know, guys who stay in the military, how they're making all this money and they never go out in the field and do anything, and they living in these mud holes during the monsoon season. It was just stinking mud hole that you had to slosh through, and it's really, really good. But this book, The Last Day, is really interesting. And I came to this one passage, and he's talking about these small towns where the people come, where all the, you know, most of the draftees came from, were these small towns, you know, in Oregon, you know, just all over. And this one is Beardsville, Ohio, May 17th, 1970. The first hot winds of summer had begun to blow through the American heartlands. As I drove into Beardsville, past rows of magnolias and elms and faded billboards that say George Washington himself farmed here. Beardsville has one main street, which is State Highway 556, coming in from the coal hills of West Virginia, going on to Jerusalem, Hannibal, and Cincinnati. It has buildings of gaunt gray and white clapboard, a general store run by Dewey, and a barbershop run by Kelly, a hairdresser and hairdressers over which hangs the sign, Dior Wigs Made to Order. And beyond the junkyard is the high school, where in 2 days' time, 17 young men of the senior class of 1970 will receive their diplomas and then stride across the football field up to the hill to where the class of 65, 66, 67, and 68 are enshrined. in the graveyard, Jack Pittman, Bob Lucas, Charlie Snag, Rick Rucker, and Dwayne Greeley, all of them born here and grown up here, all of them killed in places where names their parents cannot even pronounce. Beelzeville has a population of fewer than 500. The national ratio of Vietnam deaths is one killed for every 6,000 Americans. In Beelzeville, it was one in 90. It is in places like Beelzeville. It is places like Beelzeville on the cold, scarred slopes and in the sour little hollows that the poorest, least known Americans live. Less than 3%, 3% of the boys go to college. The rest go to the mines or to the war in Vietnam. When Bob Lucas' body came home to Beesville last year, everyone filled the streets for his funeral. Keith Harper got up and said a few angry words. Enough is enough. The way they're decimating our boys just isn't right. Keith Harper is Beesville's undertaker and has buried all five boys. The day after Lucas' funeral, he called up the county treasurer, Ray Starkey, and said, "Ray, we got to do something." Starkey called up Congressman Charles Miller, who said he would see if he could get the boys moved around in the war zone a little bit. Keep them out of it, you know. So this kind of thing won't happen again right away. The Congressman Miller called the Pentagon, who told him, in effect, to mind his own business. Jack Pittman, age 19, was the first to die. Jack was an only child and lived with his parents at a two-story house opposite their peach orchard. Since Jack died in July of 66, his mother has left his room as it was. She and Earl seldom go upstairs. These days, Earl Pittman works in the afternoon shift at the nearby aluminum plant. Because the price of peaches has not changed for 20 years, the plant is owned by a company that makes shells for Vietnam. On March 18, 1966, Jack wrote home. Excuse me again. I lost my place. "They gave me a machine gun and a 45 caliber pistol today. I'm not sure what I'm to do, Mom, because I'm only the radio man." That afternoon, he was ambushed and shot in the head. The first news we had was a telegram saying he had been critically wounded, said Mrs. Pittman. Then nothing for a whole week. Why, Earl and I nearly went insane. So I said, "I want to call Washington." Well, the man on the phone at the Pentagon just said to me, "Listen, lady, I can't trace every kid who gets himself hurt. Yeah. Well, the next thing, a sergeant came around and told us Jack had died in an Army hospital in San Francisco. To tell the truth, I never heard of Vietnam when Jack was called to the draft. I thought it was somewhere near Panama, real close and threatening. A mile and a half away from Pittman's, in a trailer off rural Route 1, lived Kenneth and Betty Rucker, whose son Rick, also 19, was killed on May 30th, 1968. Bernie Decker, who runs the gas station, brought the telegram, says Mr. Rucker, an electrical linesman. "Bernie had two boys out there, and I knew by the look of him what this was. The telegram said Rick had been killed by friendly rocket while storming a Vietcong bunker. I still don't know what to believe." After the funeral, the Ruckers met the buddy of Rick, who had been with him when he died. "There was no Vietcong bunker," he told them. "Just a bunch of grunts sitting around eating chow when one of the guys accidentally lobbed some mortars in and blew them all up. That kind of thing happens all the time. Rick Rucker was delivered home in a plain wooden box marked in heavy type, unviewable, and this way up. The thing about that is that's what happened a lot early on back then, was that the telegrams that they got from the government was delivered by whoever was running the Western Union. You know, maybe it was the barbershop or whatever, you know, the gas station or some other place where this poor people had to go and tell a family that their son had been killed in Vietnam. Later they started sending preachers and, you know, military people out to tell people that their sons had been killed in Vietnam. But the whole thing about that story is that these small towns, you know, these kids were just poor kids, were being taken away and sent to wars. Where, like they said, they didn't even, the mothers and fathers didn't even know where Vietnam was, and dying in these huge amounts, just tons of things, you know. In 1968, the worst year of the war, they were all horrible years of the war, where so many died that year. I can't imagine all the caskets coming home with all these people in all these little bitty towns all over this country, and their parents not being able to open the caskets because of, you know, what was inside. It's just terrible. Just terrible. And this has been Black History Month. You know, to me, it should be Black History every day. You know, this country was built on the back, literally on the back of African Americans, brought here not because they wanted to be, but because they were slaves. And a lot of guys in Vietnam early on in the war were African Americans, and at the time the population was of African Americans in this country wasn't that high, but the percentage of guys in combat units in Vietnam was really high. And Dr. King brought that up, that so many of the young Black guys were in these combat units. You know, they weren't getting to be like truck drivers or clerks or anything. You know, they were right there in combat arms, you know, infantrymen, mortarmen, artillery, different jobs like that. And they finally kind of broke that down a little bit, and they did start putting guys as truck drivers and stuff. But boy, for a while there, that was just brutal what was happening to the Black soldiers in Vietnam. And I think about it, you know, that The war, this country has been at war since it was stolen from, you know, the people who lived here forever. They're saying that it's been a continuous war. This may be an old number, but out of the 239 years this place has been a so-called country, 222 of those years have been in a war. You know, the whole economy is a war economy. We're on a war footing, and losing all this wasted money and lives and for what? You know, that's why at the half hour I'm going to open the lines up and say, you know, why is this national interest that they're talking about? I went back and I looked through the Constitution, and I didn't see anything in there that said, you know, that we got to go to war for national interest. And so I went and looked at the enlistment forms that some guys who enlisted in the service had to say. You know, and nowhere in it says to defend the Constitution for all enemies, foreign and domestic, but nowhere in there does it say, you know, going to send you to war to for national interest to get some our oil out of their ground. I didn't see where it was at. So if you have ideas, you know, at the half hour, I'm going to open up and hear what you have to say. But I just can't. Anywhere I looked, I couldn't find it. And if you talk and argue with these right-wing freaks, they always national interest. We gotta, you know, we gotta have save our national interest and junk like that. Angie and I have been talking back and forth ever since she left me here and went up there, and I miss her a lot. And she sent me some really good, interesting stuff she got off the internet. Some of it was from military.com, and some of it was from Newsweek. And the one thing that, you know, that I always harp about is suicides, the suicide rates of people coming back from the war, and even active duty people. And one of the things that is happening now is God, I don't know how they're working on this. You know, we're working on this. As suicides in the VA hospitals parking lots. These guys are going out to their cars and blowing their brains out in the parking lots of these veterans hospitals. And it's gone up. The percentages of this happening in the last year or so has gone up. Just unbelievable percentage. In the Vietnam War, from, you know, they say 63, 64 to 73, that 58,000 of us were killed or murdered. And in the last 2 years, almost 60,000 veterans have committed suicide. And it's just, you think about that, and so they pump this money into these new programs. We're going to pump the $700 million into the system, and we're going to come, you know, we're going to find out why all this is happening. Well, we know why it's happening. We're going to war, and war messes people up. So I just get so angry at these people. You know, if you see somebody, you know, and it's uniform or whatever, you know, don't, you know, go up to them and start screaming at them and all that, because that's not going to work. You know, just give them the facts. You know, how come so many of you guys are blowing your brains out? You know, why'd you go into service in the first place? And, you know, just talk to them. And I do it all the time. You know, I do it all the time. And one of the things I always get back is I couldn't find a job. I'm married. I got a kid, and I had to have a job. So that just goes to show you what this country is all about. And this fool in the White House, this idiot in the White House, is so horrible. You know, he's always talking about, I'm doing this for the veterans. I'm doing that for the veterans. And then he's cutting stuff out of the budget all the time, you know. And folks that have been in the service, we all remember the Stars and Stripes magazine. We used to get the Stars and Stripes magazine. And it was made by, not by the military, but by a civilian group of veterans. They'd made these forever. And, Trump's cut out the funding for that. Something simple just like that. Some entertainment just like that. And he cuts it out. So, you know, he's no friend. Man, the guy is just leading us down the road to fascism. And nobody, all of his crazy friends, you know, just, oh, I'm so angry. So angry. And this is really interesting that now these military bases and some veterans hospitals are getting these phone calls that are just racist phone calls. and threatening to shoot people at these hospitals, and how everybody that goes to these hospitals are, you know, a bunch of lazy people, and they're getting a lot of threats at these military hospitals. And that is just unimaginable that that's happening, that they would be saying something like that, you know? And I don't like, you know, war is a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. And another thing that's came up is that now in the military, just because you belong to a white supremacist organization, that is no longer a reason to kick you out of the military. That just happened. That is no longer a reason to kick you out of the military if you're a white racist. And they, one-third of all troops in the military have said they have seen racism in the military. They have seen white supremacy in the military. And that's really a high, high number of racism in the military, where these guys walk around with their, you know, even in Vietnam, I remember in Vietnam that some of these redneck crackers from the South having that rebel flag. They carried the rebel flag. And that's just crazy. And Angie just sent me this morning, she sent me some really interesting stuff. She says that the United States military has lost $1 billion worth of weapons and equipment. $1 billion worth of equipment. That is just a staggering amount. Well, look how much money they get every year anyway. And she sent me another one saying that, I just lost it. Here we go. Saying that that the military, as they're pulling out of Afghanistan, Syria, supposedly Syria and these places, they're leaving behind all this equipment, all these weapons and ammunition and just all kinds of stuff, and that's going into the hands of ISIS and those types of people. And the one that she sent me is, it was in Newsweek, and it is Syria. It says Syria, that they're leaving all that equipment in Syria. So to get back to it, it's such a drain on our society. You know, I no longer look at the first Gulf War. You know, it's never ended. It's continuing to this day. Continuing to this day. And the people I talk to out in Washington County and sometimes Columbia County, you know, people are just fed up with it. They're just tired of it. And every month, or, you know, men are being killed, you know, over, they just had some guys killed in, I think it was Syria, and then Afghanistan, and then Iraq. You know, it just keeps on going and going and going and going. You know, sometimes a war's got to end. It's got to end. And somehow we just got to get these people, you know, when you have a guy like Trump, who's never been in the military, who does not like the military, who calls the general stupid, and that he would never go to war with him. Well, he never went to war when he had his chance to go to war. I have a friend, Mike, who had asthma as a kid, and he had a deferment so he didn't have to go to Vietnam. Well, Mike got he went to the military, and he signed a waiver. And anything that would, you know, hurt his breathing or whatever, while he's in the service, they wouldn't have to pay for it. And he got a waiver, and he went to Vietnam. But here are these guys like Rush Limbaugh and Trump and all these guys who had these minimal military deferments, who could have had what was Trump. I think Limbaugh had a boil on his rear end that they could have taken care of that, and he could have went into service, but he didn't want to. Trump had spurs, heel spurs, or whatever they call it. They would have snipped those right off, and he would have went. I knew guys in Vietnam that their eyesight, they should have never been in Vietnam because their eyesight wasn't that good, but they were in there. You know, guys with bad knees and stuff, they were still in there. But, of course, they came from poor working-class families, so, you know, let's just take them in because they needed bodies. Bodies, 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 bodies. And that's what they did. They just drafted all of us guys, gave us a little training, and shoved us into the meat grinder. And so that's just pretty horrible. But Trump saying how he likes the military, I can't imagine him sitting in the Pentagon calling those generals stupid. You know, I just can't imagine what was going through their minds, you know, this freak in there. Ah, just horrible. Tammy, let's go ahead and play that second song, and then we'll open up the phone lines and we'll talk about this. So
when this bloody war is over, no more soldiering for me. When I get my civvy clothes on, oh, how happy I will be. No more church parades on Sunday, no more pudding in for leave. How I'll miss the sergeant major, how his poor old heart will grieve. Thank you.
You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And that song, I was just going through some songs, and I heard that one, and it's the music is "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," you know, and they just put new words to this song, you know, and boy, hits it right on the nail. I'm Marvin, and Tammy's in the engineering room, engineering her little heart away. Like I said, I'm going to take some phone calls. We don't have a whole lot of time, but Tim's on the line now. Tim, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing okay, bro. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm hanging.
And I appreciate your show, man.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I'm 68. I was in the last year of the lottery, number 91, and I got out of it by telling them that I didn't recognize or accept their authority to determine who I hated, who I killed, and that. But I wasn't going to go to jail, and I wasn't going to run to Canada. And I told them I would go and become the best killer I could become.
Well.
And the first chance I had, I'd kill every officer in my unit and all the equipment I could.
Yeah, you know, Tim, that happened in Vietnam.
I know it did.
Yeah, it happened in Vietnam.
I was pre-planning the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it dropped from 1A to 4F.
Good for you. Good for you.
So then I ran a camp out in the state forest illegally, and I helped AWOL soldiers and draft dodgers get out.
Oh, man, good for you. Yeah,
and,
that's great. You know that a lot of, you know, you always hear of guys that went to Canada.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of guys went to Mexico.
I'm surprised more didn't.
Yeah, it's really interesting. A lot of guys, they just packed it up and they just went to Mexico, and you know, more power to them. You know, I don't have any hard feelings towards folks who did that. The only hard feelings I have is these guys that didn't go, but now are sitting in the White House and sending other people to go. You know what I mean?
Oh, I dig it. Yeah.
Tim, I want to thank you for calling. I got some more calls in, and I want to tell you, thanks a lot for calling, buddy, and thanks for listening.
And I think people better get ready.
Get ready. You're right. Thanks, buddy.
Just take care.
Yep. Bye-bye. Okay, thanks. The next call we have is from Tremaine is on the line. Am I saying your name right?
No, you got it just right. I just want to tell you that my wife and I were about your same age, and we were resisting Vietnam at the University of Washington in 61, 62, real early, and we carried it through. You know, we've been doing all that all our life.
Yeah.
We really appreciate your program and your passion, and we share your frustration about the maniacs that are running our country and the maniac who's running the White House. I don't know what else to say, but it's just totally frustrating.
It is so frustrating. Just
and we just want to become lunatics about it, but we don't.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, my favorite anti-war song is, and I know you played it before, and the band played Waltzing Matilda.
That is an amazing
song. That to me,
song.
We hear that song and we cry.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway, Marvin, we're so happy that you're on the air. You are really a great asset to our community.
Well,
and we love your passion. We love your passion.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you betcha. Bye.
Okay, bye. I want to, to talk a little bit. If you want to call, you know, we don't have to, you know, talk about, what I brought up. But I want to talk about it. And that is the national interest. What is the national interest? And I went, like I said, I went to all these places and looked. And, you know, this right wing, I can't get it on my computer right now, but I had this whole thing about they're talking about, you know, how the United States is the bright light in the world and if it wasn't for us, you know, that we would all be under some horrible dictatorship, which we're under right now. But they're saying, you know, we have to make every place good for democracy. for democracy. And when you say democracy, they're saying something that chills me to my bones, that we're sending our troops to democracy. Not that we're being attacked, you know, by some foreign force or anything, but for democracy. And democracy is nothing but imperialism and capitalism. And I was talking to this young black woman the other day out in Washington County, and she's a veteran, and she was telling me about what was happening to her and when she was overseas, and I hear the same stories from my sisters, you know, about how they were treated by the guys in their units, you know, how they thought, you know, that they thought that we were, you know, we were equal to them. We, you know, women went out on the lines with the grunts, you know, these women that were interpreters over there, these women who dealt with the women, but in these Muslim countries, they were right there with those guys, and they get treated like second-class citizens, you know. Like earlier today, Malcolm X said, a second-class citizen is nothing more than a slave. Nothing more than a slave. And our sisters are being treated that way in the military. I don't want them to be in the military in the first place, but I don't want them to be treated like that. To be treated like that. And she was also talking about, you know, different... We got into words, word talking. And she says, you know what scares me? She says, socialism doesn't scare me. Communism doesn't scare me. You know, she says, you know what scares me is capitalism. She says, capitalism scares me. She says, in this country, all the money is going to the top. All the money is going to the top. And she's got little kids she has to take care of. She's got two jobs. And she's just a wonderful, wonderful person. A wonderful person. She got divorced when she came back, you know, which happened a lot. You know, minority women have a really, really high divorce rates when they come out of the service. You know, and she's one of them. And she's such a nice, you know, a nice person. And I just, you know, we got another call. Eric, we got a call from Eric. How you doing, Eric?
Hey, how are you? It's been a long time since I talked to you.
Yeah, I recognize your voice.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can now. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was down at the rest area just a little bit south of Wilsonville last time I called.
Yeah.
And I was especially taken by that guy that said he was in the lottery. I was in the first lottery, and I had been registered as the conscientious objector, but I still went to my CO. Since I had a really high number, he would, get out of here, you communist. You got out. I said, I don't want to fight people.
Oh, my gosh, no kidding. Wow.
And they sent me up to the Sierras, and I was working up there and file remediation.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing is, if we kept doing that file remediation since 1970, there would have been no Paradise Fire. There'd have been no Santa Rosa fire, no Redding fire, and all those horrible fires in Central California.
Yeah, that's true. You know, a lot of guys like that COs, concept objectors, were sent to work in hospitals.
Right, yeah, right.
A lot of guys went to work in the hospitals, and some of them in civilian hospitals, if I remember right. A lot of them in civilian hospitals.
Yeah, I think so. But I want to thank you a lot. It's been good to hear you again. Thank you.
Oh, you too, buddy. Hang in there, okay?
All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
I remember him. I remember him calling before and, you know, hearing what he had to say. I want to get back to this whole thing about national interest. Anything could be a national interest to this country. Anything. National interest. Oil, you know, minerals, anything to them could be a national interest. So they can just, well, we got to send you guys now. We're going to have to, let's see, where haven't we been in a while? Let's go to Africa. You know, they got a lot of natural resources down there. We can build up some bases down there and we'll give some jobs to these kids. We'll give them jobs, just like they gave jobs to McNamara's 100,000. Some of those poor guys couldn't even hardly read or write, you know. But we're going to give them jobs. McNamara, Tammy and I were talking about Jane Fonda. Jane Fonda's going to be at the 50th anniversary of the May 4th Kent State massacre. And she's going to be talking there. And Joe Walsh is going to be there. And David Crosby's going to be there. And my friend Joe Lewis, who was shot at Kent State, you know, he invites me to go. And I'm really working hard so I can go to Kent State and be with Joe on 50th anniversary. And if you look at some of the pictures on Kent State, you can see Joe just the back of his head. I think the next one is the back of Joe's head when he's way up in front of this crowd and there's nobody around him, you know. And then the next picture you see is all these people running and Joe's still up there. And then the next picture I think I saw of Joe, he was laying on the ground. He'd been shot. And that makes me really angry too. My cousin Bill was in Vietnam when that happened. He was a combat medic in an infantry company, and he was saying that they were guys were angry that they would shoot college students. He said they were really, really angry that this government, this military, would shoot unarmed college students. They killed four young people. One of them was shot in the back as he was walking to his class. He wasn't even part of the protest. Wasn't even part of the protest. And he died. And that, you know, I just get angry at this. Tim's back? Tim?
Yeah, hey.
Yeah.
Hey, brother. I wanted to make a point about the national interest.
Yeah, go ahead.
After I got rid of the military, mm-hmm. I eventually joined the Peace Corps.
Ooh.
And
ooh.
I went down to Paraguay. Mm-hmm. And from Paraguay, I went to Pinochet's Chile, mm-hmm. and Alfonsín's Argentina. And, of course, Paraguay itself was 35-year-old fascist dictatorship.
Right.
And when I got down there, Jimmy Carter had just lost to Reagan. It was a transition period.
Right.
And America was well respected. They had streets and century Reagan and the successive presidents after that.
Mm-hmm.
They all switched it around again. They started interfering. And then a great deal of resentment and hate and fear of
right.
America. Yeah. And I believe that I love America, the idea of freedom, democracy,
mm-hmm.
and not that it's perfect or that we ever had it,
mm-hmm.
but it's a good ideal
yeah.
for us.
It's really
and,
a good idea.
If we want to have a democracy in this world, we have to support other democracies. It's in our national interest to do that so
yeah.
that we survive.
Exactly.
As free peoples, right? And we can't do that by sending troops all over the place.
Yeah.
And interfering with people and
yep.
creating hatred.
Yep.
You got to create some love, brother.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what you got to do.
Yeah.
You got to do it on an international scale.
Yep.
Because of Peace Corps, I went and got a degree in international development.
Oh, good for you.
Change. And I was going to go back and do some stuff
good
in
stuff.
Paraguay.
yeah.
But That's okay. Another story.
Okay, thanks.
But anyways.
Thanks for calling again and bringing that story up, because that's really interesting. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, too. So thanks again for calling back.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Here.
He
One
brings,
world.
Sorry. He brings up a really good point, is that we only defend, we only go for dictators. You know? I think that all the money we're spending, boy, we spend so much money on the military, you know, Department of War, which it should be called the Department of War, because that's what it is. It's war. It's making war, being prepared for war, building war machines. And who gets rich when we're making these war machines is definitely not, you know, the workers. They, you know, they they don't get a lot of money. So, but then it, the whole thing about that is all this money's getting sucked out. Sucked out and sucked out and sucked out. And the military's, you know, getting bigger and bigger. And then I just heard that they're going to cut back on some of the troops. They're going to get rid of some of these troops. And didn't I just hear where the idiot in the White House just started a Space Force or something like that? Some stupid thing, you know, Space Force. And they're even talking about militarizing space. You know, the whole deal when we went into space, that all these countries, you made this decision, you know, we're not going to weaponize space. You know, and then here's the United States saying, well, we're going to weaponize space. I just heard that they weren't, that the military had not been making their quotas on bodies. And so they've changed their whole recruiting plan now, where they're going after the mothers and fathers to try to get them to talk their kids into going into the military. You know, here they are kicking guys out, men and women out, and then they're going to recruit some more. They started this Space Force or whatever it's going to be. You know, this, you know, Department of War, it's the Department of War. That's what it is. And when you talk about the Department of War, bottom line, people get killed. People get murdered in the war. And who's that? It's the poor kids. The poor working class kids. That's all it is. In my unit in Vietnam, boy, I tell you what, there was a lot, most of us kids came from poor families. Poor families. And that is, you know, that's just, I imagine it's the same today. You know, the people I talk to, they've all had high school diplomas. I got to give them credit for that. They had high school diplomas. But some of them didn't. Some of them had to get GEDs so they could go into the military, and the government paid for it and tutored them and everything. And then I asked them, I said, well, did you get the job that they promised you? And they said, when I went in, I went through all this stuff to be training. I was going to be a clerk. I went through all this. And then when I got to Iraq, I ended up as a machine gunner on a truck. And I had they had to show me how to use a machine gun. You know? And another woman, a young white girl, she was saying that she was going to be a baker. That she would be a baker. And she said she ended up like filling helicopters with fuel. They take these huge, you know, and she said she was out in the field and filling up helicopters with fuel. So what they say is that we'll give you this job, they train you for it and everything, but if you look at that enlistment form, it doesn't say they gotta do what they say. You know, it says right on there that we don't got to do this if we don't want it. You know, it's all the government. It's the convenience of the government. So if we need guys packing M16s or whatever, you're going to pack an M16. If they need you to fill fuel into helicopters, you're going to fill fuel into helicopters. If they want you to put bombs on aircraft flying off aircraft carriers, you're going to be doing that. And there's nothing you can do about it. And if I remember right, when I was in, you had to do two years of active duty, 2 years of active reserves, I think, and then 2 years of inactive reserves. And I think if you did 3 years of active duty, you only had to do like 3 years of inactive reserve, something like that. But now they have this clause in there, you know, where they can bring you back into the military. They can be, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, or most of it is military people, medical people, so they can go to a doctor and say, we need you in here, and you're coming in, you're going in. I mean, that's today. You know, they want you, they're going to get you. They're going to get you. So the military has such a grasp on this society, on this country, that it's just really hard to believe. Like Tim was saying, you know, if you treat people well, things work out well. You treat them bad, it's going to turn out bad. So, you know, you go to another country and they find out you're an American, you know, it's really sad. When I was in Vietnam, when the first start of the Gulf War started, there was an American tourist over there, and we were walking around looking at stuff, and Laurel and his wife had walked someplace, and some Vietnamese walked up to, and the kids always want to practice their English, and they say, where are you from? And the other American guy says, I'm from Canada. You know, I'm from Canada. And I said, I'm from America, you know. And I don't defend this country when they're indefensible. You know, if we've done wrong, we've done wrong. If we do something right, we do something right. But the military in this country has really got a hold on us. And I just don't like that at all. I just don't like that. And, you know, there's some nights I go home, if I've been talking to people, you know, I go home and I'll sit down and I'll just think about how horrible it is for some of these people coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, coming back from Syria, or coming back off a ship after long duties, you know, being away from their home for 2 and 3 years. And I think how horrible that is, how horrible it is, and that they gotta, you know, try to get back into their lives. And a lot of people, you know, when their time's up, they get out. And a lot of these people that earned, you know, they can go to college, they can use some of the money that they put away in the military, and they can go to college, but they don't. They don't do it. That's a money-making thing for the military, because these people don't use that money that they put away for college. They don't use it. You know, like somebody told me one time, if the military is such a good job, why do they have recruiters? You know, why do they have recruiting stations? You know, why do they do that? Because no one... I said, that's a pretty good one. And then I had this African-American minister say one time, the military is a job for these kids. And the guy is standing next to me and said, that's a pretty horrible job. It was a black kid. That's a pretty horrible job, he said. And I just want to say thanks for letting me rant and rave, and thanks for the people who called in. And I hope you really think about this and what we can do about changing this whole thing. We gotta start really organizing ourselves. We have to get together, and we gotta put a stop to this crazy madness. We'll be back on March 20th at 9 a.m. And there it is.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British Wars. The young land started.
started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant, United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore.